Today is Friday, June 5th, 2020. This is a part four Grand Canyon oral history interview with Butch Farabee. That's Charles Butch Farabee, spelled F-A-R-A-B-E-E. And my name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Butch. How are you today?
Good.
Good.
I think officially it's actually Junior.
Is it Charles Farabee Jr.?
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah.
No, this is important. I had to get it right. Butch, may we have your permission to record this interview over the phone?
Yes.
Thank you. We left off part three with your discussions with Frank Kowski about returning to the Park Service, having worked for the Tucson Police Department for 3 years. And this is in 1969. Can you talk to me about the transition from Tucson? Now you're married now. You're married to Ann. How did that transition to Lake Mead work?
Well, I may have to think about this a little bit, I suppose. Frank, who was then the regional director for the Southwest region, which Lake Mead National Recreation Area was in, he got a position description written specifically to include or incorporate my police experience because they needed what amounted to a highway patrolman, a ranger who could work the North Shore Road, which is that goes from Las Vegas Wash to Echo Bay, but pretty remote. There's nothing for, 30-some miles out there. But it's also an access to Las Vegas. And in those days, the state of Nevada did not have an upper speed limit. So you could drive as fast as you wanted to, I guess, within reason. Except that, you were inside the recreation area where the laws were a little bit different. So they wanted somebody who could work there independently, work at night principally by themselves to watch for a lot of drinking, a lot of speeding. So they created that job for me. They actually, not too long into my tenure there, they actually got a what would amount to would be like a California Highway Patrol equipped cruiser, Park Service patrol car, and it was painted the right colors and that sort of thing. But it had a big engine in it, and I was a patrolman on that North Shore Road working at night. I don't think, if I recall, I'm not even sure I even had a gun. I often didn't. Generally, I didn't, actually. If I did have a gun, it was, in the days when you had it in the glove compartment or in a briefcase.
And since right.
I did not own a briefcase, I'm sure that it was stashed away.
Huh.
And that was a different time in the Park Service in general, which is sort of a whole different issue. But there are any number of rangers of my age, my generation, who can testify to, you did not wear a weapon on site, although at night it was a little more lenient. But during the daytime, you pretty much did not. But anyway, I made this decision to leave the Tucson Police Department. Because I always wanted, I loved the Park Service, I loved what they stood for, although leaving the police department was pretty hard in many ways, because I really enjoyed doing what I did, and I've always told people that I thought that being a policeman, and I can't testify to every cop for sure, but for me, being a policeman in Tucson in that era was one of the hardest jobs I've ever had, perhaps even the hardest, to do it, with conscience and integrity, but at the same time with some common sense. I thought it was one of the most challenging things I've ever done, for sure.
Wow.
So, but I still love working in the parks, and I was very impressed when I went through the training center with the organization and the overall philosophy and direction that I thought the National Park Service and, you know, the conservation preservation ethics were taking. You know, that was right when, pretty close to when Silent Spring by Rachel Carson came out.
Right.
So, you know, and the preservation conservation movement was starting to blossom further. So anyway, I bought into all of that, and when I went to Lake Mead, sort of as a minor aside, I've always thought that my contribution to being a ranger in the national parks was not so much as for the conservation and the preservation mentality of the agency, because there were plenty of my peers who bought into that, hook, line, and sinker and really got into it. I always thought that my contribution could be in working with people. And I know that not everybody is a good person, although, you know, I tend to think that I'm much more positive than negative when it comes to interacting with the tourists and the visitors. So, but I've always thought that my contribution would be able to work with people in all kinds of different situations, good and bad, and let the real preservation, the real conservation policies, that's not the right word, but for what the Park Service stands for, there were lots of people who were very passionate about that, very dedicated to that concept, and I thought that I could make a contribution by working with the people who were in a law enforcement, less than the conservation. Frame of mind. That's the right way to phrase that. But anyway, I don't know if that makes sense to you, Tom, at all. But that was, I thought, my thing.
Well, it seems like, you know, the Park Service has a lot of people that are focused on resource planning and management that is mandated to preserve the resource unimpaired for future generations. But it also needs front line people that are interfacing with the public have that preservation and conservation background always behind them.
Yeah.
You're
right. I mean, you have phrased it better than I can. I just thought that at least initially, you know, for the first several jobs in Lake Mead and then Death Valley and then into Yosemite, that was sort of my direction. But again, you know, in the background was my empathy towards the environment, my empathy towards conservation and preservation, my background in enjoying the out-of-doors, through hiking and camping and climbing and caving, and I hadn't got into the water yet particularly, although I guess diving, I suppose that's right too.
Right.
But so that was the way I sort of entered my job. So I was asked to go to Lake Mead, or I accepted the job to go to Lake Mead. I had actually, as a sort of an interesting introduction to Lake Mead, I had just gotten my pilot's license in 1968, right before I got married, And my instructor, his parents owned a little mom and pop arrow company, and as a wedding present, he gave me the use of a Cessna 172, which is a four-place for aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me the flight time from Tucson to Las Vegas. So another couple, myself and my wife, flew to Las Vegas. And in doing so, we landed in Boulder City, and we were met by several of the rangers from the park. And they took us out on the big patrol boat.
Oh, wow.
At Boulder Beach or Hemingway Harbor, and took a tour around the Boulder Basin and down to the dam and that sort of thing. And they knew, of course, that I was transferring up there, and that I had, at one time, had already been a permanent, although admittedly for a short time. But I sort of spoke the language, but at the same time also brought this police, law enforcement experience with me as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they also knew that, I had postponed my enter on duty date a little bit until my wife graduated from the University of Arizona. So from Boulder City, we flew into Las Vegas. Now, I've got about 50 hours flying time. But I was pretty comfortable, and I didn't deviate. I wasn't like I was a hot dog out there. I mm-hmm. was pretty conscious of the fact that that was not my plane and that they were giving me, I don't know, whatever it was, maybe 6 or 7 hours of flight time. Up and back.
Right.
So that was my real introduction to Lake Mead, and then we transferred up. We had to move ourselves in this case. So I had a U-Haul trailer and towed one of our two cars up there. And we went to Echo Bay, which is a fairly remote part of Lake Mead. And Boulder Beach is not so remote, but there are probably six or seven other places at Lake Mead that are fairly isolated, and Echo Bay was one of them.
So Butch, just I'm curious about the lay of the land. Hemingway Harbor and Boulder Bay are right down near Boulder City, but the North Shore Road is farther north, and there's a whole little marina out there, isn't there, that connects?
Yeah, well, there were actually three of them. There was Colville Bay.
Okay.
That's halfway to Echo Bay, and then Echo Bay, and then above it was Overton Landing, and as the lake would go up and down with its capacity and its, elevation.
Right.
Overton Landing was always sort of marginally operated. I don't know that it made any kind of a profit. And part of what my job was to overlook them as well.
And Colville Bay and Echo Bay had roads that went west back to Vegas. Is that right?
No, not exactly. The North Shore Road had just been completed maybe a couple of years before I would get there.
Okay.
And it would go from Las Vegas Wash and skirt the mountains, and then there'd be a side road that went down to the lake at Colville Bay.
Okay.
And it was a dead end. I mean, it would drive into the water. You'd end up in the water. And that was, 5 or 6 miles in length,
okay.
that side road. And then North Shore would continue north and east up to Echo Bay.
Got it.
And the same thing existed there. There was a side road that went down to Echo Bay, and it would end in the water as well. And it was roughly, you would think, having lived there for a year and a half, I would know this, but It was roughly 5 or 6 miles in length as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there were three houses, three Mission 66 houses, and a couple of like duplex apartments, and a little maintenance yard, and then a hotel and a marina. And a pretty, pretty busy marina for that area. And then the road, the North Shore, would continue up to the little town of Overton.
Okay.
Again, with a side road that went down to Overton Landing.
All
so
right.
There was nothing other than maybe a couple of dirt roads. There was nothing that did as you were suggesting, going east towards Las Vegas.
Got it. So it was the North Shore Road, and that's, what, maybe 30 or 40 miles long?
Yeah. I'm not so sure it was 40, but between 30 and 40, I believe.
Okay.
And, my memory and of some of the specifics is a little bad.
Yeah, no worries. And then what was Ann thinking she would do? You got a nice house out there in Echo Bay. It's 30 miles outside of Vegas, which is kind of nice. It's quiet out there, I would assume. But if she's going to be teaching or working, it, that's going to be a commute into Vegas every day.
Well, no, she didn't do any of that. Her degree was in geography.
Okay.
Which, I think is a great degree, but it's probably not too useful. When it comes to any kind of profession. But the fact is, she got, she's a graduate, very smart woman, very independent, very self-starter. So she ended up working at the hotel in the registration, part of the hotel, the Echo Bay Hotel, or I guess that's what it was.
Okay.
And she worked there, and then when they developed a little visitor center at Valley of Fire State Park, which is a pretty unique geological part of that whole basin. It's really a unique area. But anyway, she, was... very attractive, very articulate, very organized, well-spoken, and she was a natural, and she liked being out there by, not so much by herself, but at least, pretty remote.
Uh-huh.
And she ended up running that visitor center for the state, and she had, I think, a supervisor, and then maybe there might have been a maintenance man in there someplace as well.
Right.
So between the two of them, and we were only at Echo Bay for about a year and a half anyway.
Okay.
But partway through, not too many months into my initial assignment there, the management there, the superintendent and chief ranger, et cetera, decided they really needed me more as an area ranger rather than just a patrolman on the North Shore.
Okay. What was the difference?
Well, the difference was that as an area ranger, one, I got a lot more out on the lake.
Okay.
And my responsibility included the North Shore, and I did a lot of the same sorts of things as a patrolman, but my interest was more towards off-road driving, poaching, boating, boat inspections, boat accidents, that sort of thing for the whole area. And during that year and a half, I went up to the fire camp on the Shivwitz Plateau and spent several different shifts up there. And there are some interesting stories regarding that as well.
Like what?
Well, one that comes to mind, or maybe two, or they might have been even combined. But this is a day when Lake Mead had an aircraft, for one thing.
Okay.
And you know, at the end of my there's a little airstrip at the Shiblets Fire Camp, which is again one of the most remote parts of the United States. Mm. Actually, I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's terribly interesting, very remote, lots of archaeology out there, a lot of resources, and but there's also a fire camp there with a couple little trailer and a Quonset hut and some fire equipment and what have you. And so I was out there for 2 weeks on one go-around, and my first wedding anniversary popped up, and the superintendent, Roger Allen was his name, Allen, was having a home built in Boulder City, but in the interim, he actually lived out there at Echo Bay, and he was a Department of the Interior certified pilot.
Oh, wow.
So he would occasionally bring that aircraft out, much to the consternation of the park had a real pilot as well.
Oh, boy. Uh-huh.
GS-12, I think, pilot, perhaps, or at least GS-11 pilot. Who was an old-time pilot that taught the wasps how to fly across the ocean in World War II.
Hmm.
So he had, like, you know, 30,000 flying hours.
Right.
And was on his, you know, the end of his career, and this is sort of the way to taper off. But the superintendent lived out there. We got to be pretty good acquaintances. And, of course, his wife and my wife got along famously. You know, I sort of maintained a sort of a professional distance without, you know, without being rude or anything.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, he recognized that it was my first wedding anniversary, and he had the pilot fly up and pick me up at the Shiblets Plateau and bring me home.
Uh-huh.
For my wedding anniversary, which I thought really was pretty much of a class act.
Hmm.
Obviously, it was self-serving on my part, but I also thought that, you know, he had his employees in mind and the well-being.
Yeah.
And so I appreciated it. I'm sure that my wife appreciated it as well. But again, those were the days when the management, at least at Lake Mead, and I think elsewhere, although I can't totally speak to that, but certainly at Lake Mead, you know, my wife went up they gave us a tour of the park with her in the aircraft, and then she was more than welcome to go out on one of our boats, you know, at Echo Bay. I mean, she couldn't take it out. I would be the one taking it out. But she was welcome to be on board.
Uh-huh.
And I think the idea was that, you know, the tourists, the visitors, would see the boat, and there was just a presence. It wasn't that we were stopping them and talking to them or anything like that.
Right. Just,
they saw this. It's like having a police car. You know, you see the police car and you know that they're out and about.
That's right.
So so that was one of the better things about the Shiblets. And then in one of those two-week sessions, it was during the monsoon times, and I was out there by myself, and it's really a two-and-a-half or so-hour drive from St. George, Utah, out there.
Yeah.
And a lightning storm came in one night, and it's one of the most intimidating things I've ever experienced, to where you almost felt like you wanted to crawl underneath the bed in your little trailer.
Wow.
The lightning was so intense, and it was constant. It was like being in, although I've never experienced this for real, but it seems to me like being in the middle of a battle where there's big guns going off all the time. And I don't know that I literally crawled under the bed, but I think I would like to have crawled under the bed. So the next morning, I went up to the top of Mount Dellenbaugh, which has a lot of history. For those who know much about the river running, know that that's part of Separation Canyon, where the three guys left off of Powell's.
Right. There's an inscription up there.
Yep.
From William Dunn, is that right?
Yep, that's right. It's on Mount Dellenbaugh.
Okay.
And, it, you know, that was part of what I was supposed to just, you know, keep an eyeball on. And you had to walk up there. The road was bad enough that you couldn't drive up to the top anymore, although there used to be a road there. But I'd go up there. That was part of my job. It was a fire camp. That's what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up there, and there was something like 25 different smokes.
Wow.
Taking place. And I'm all out there, totally out there by myself. I've got a good four-wheel drive truck. But, you know, there's only so much that one guy can do with that many sightings of smokes.
Birch, yeah. Was John Riffey out there at Grand Canyon National Monument?
Well, Riffey was there at the time. I actually flew over there with my wife. I rented a plane from Boulder City, and we flew out there to spend an afternoon with John. He was there at that time.
Can we take a little diversion here? We'll come back to the smokes in a minute. Can you tell me what you recall about John Riffey?
Well, of course, he was at Two Weep or Tall Weep Overlook Ranger Station, little airstrip, which actually is not quite in the park. It was right on the fence line right outside the park.
Right.
And his little airplane Pogo, I think.
That's right.
Was out there, which I think was a Super Cub.
That's right.
And I wrote him a letter. You know, I never met the man before this, but I wrote him a letter, I think, or somehow I communicated with him anyway. And I couldn't do it directly. I mean, it wasn't like we had a radio or anything that we could talk to him directly.
Okay.
But in some fashion, I communicated with him and found out that on such and such a day, he would be there. And I made an arrangement. I said, if I fly over there, you know, can we spend a little time with you? And he was very gracious. And I think, you know, again, he was a self-starter, but he's also very used to being by himself. His wife would be there occasionally, but she wasn't there at that time. I never did meet her. But we set it up for some afternoon. I flew in. So my wife and I are flying over in a little Cessna 150 over the middle of the Grand Canyon, you know, probably some of the most rugged territory in the lower 48, at least.
Mm.
And, you know, and I've got, you know, I don't have that many more hours since I got my license, maybe 50 or 60 hours total. But I flew out there and met with him, and we spent several hours, and we went up to the ranger station, which was his home as well, and had a light lunch, I believe, and probably something to, you know, refreshments, iced tea or something like that. And spent some time with us. He took us out to Tall Weep Point itself, the overlook, the little campground. And I remember John as being, for one thing, he was, you know, a lot older than me. He might have been in his mid-50s at that point.
Right.
But, you know, he was sort of a tie back to an older era. His interest was principally in the resource, because where he was living out there, and frankly, I don't know much about his earlier history. I don't know where else he had been before that or what his career was before that.
Right.
Although I do have a little biography on him here someplace.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, his interest was principally in the resource and that end of the park, and sort of keeping track of the river runners. And he would get visitors out there that would come in from Kanab and probably St. George. You can go through Bundyville, I guess. So I found him very entertaining, very willing to spend some time with a young ranger and his wife. You know, he was just generally a nice person. You know, and he wasn't, you know, he was old enough that he wasn't that caught up in any kind of an ego thing like the rest of us young bucks were.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I'm no authority on John, although after I got to the Grand Canyon, I you know, met with him once or twice also along the way, although not professionally. He, you know, he ended up dying pretty quickly, but so I don't have too much more to say about going out there and spending an afternoon with him, I guess.
Nice. Well, that's fun. That's a nice snapshot of him there. And then Roger Allen, what recollections do you have of Roger?
Well, Roger came from the Everglades where he had been the superintendent, and I don't frankly know exactly why he left the Everglades to Lake Mead. I'm sure there are political and Park Service reasons for doing that, but in some ways he didn't fit in, but he was an authority figure. He was very nice to my wife and I. I think that he was probably a pretty good manager, although I never was a recipient too much of, you know, I was so far down the totem pole that I don't know that I ever was a recipient of any real policy kinds of things that he instituted. And then he ended up leaving Lake Mead not too long after I did, I believe, and went to Olympic National Park as the superintendent. And when he was, he must have, if I recall right, had some history, some career history as with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is, I think, where he ended up becoming a pilot.
Huh.
For them, he was a pilot biologist, probably, and he brought that flying experience with him to Lake Mead, but he also brought this management from the Everglades to Lake Mead as well.
Okay.
So, you know, a nice man. I don't remember if he had any kind of a military history. He probably did, but I just don't recall that. So, and then not too long after, you know, he went up and got, or not he, but he had the pilot pick me up at the Shivowitz Fire Camp. They ended up moving into Boulder City where they had built this house. And so our paths really didn't cross until the very, very end, which is a pretty embarrassing thing on my part, but I'll share it anyway, is I bought a little airplane. Luscombe 8A, 1946, 65 horsepower.
How do you spell that?
Luscombe, Luscombe.
Okay, they made aircraft engines, didn't they?
You might be thinking about Lycoming.
Oh, maybe.
I don't recall that they made engines, but they might have. I'm no authority on any of this.
The Luscombe was a little two-seater?
Oh, yeah, it's a little two-seater. It's almost a one-seater, except there's a side-by-side.
Okay.
And you have a stick for your control, but the big thing is that it was a tail dragger.
Okay.
And I learned in a tricycle gear, like most pilots do, as a rule. But there's a big difference between a tricycle gear, which has a front wheel in the front, or has a wheel in the front, as opposed to a tail dragger, where the wheel is in the, at the very end of the plane.
Right.
And there's a whole different landing and takeoff. The flying itself isn't too much different, but the landing and takeoff is a lot different because you have to control the aircraft with your feet, with the pedals.
And you can't see the runway ahead of you. You have to kind of...
Well, yeah, that's right. And that is correct. But in a small plane, you're not very far off the ground anyway. But in this case, the Luscombe was sort of notorious for having a fairly narrow wheel. The wheels are fairly close. I mean, they weren't broad.
Okay.
And the farther apart, of course, the more control you have. And if the wheels are close together, then you have lesser control. Well, and the guy that I bought this airplane from in Overton, the little town of Overton, which is where we got our mail and went grocery shopping and stuff, you know, probably didn't have more than, I don't know, 500 people living in it at the time. Now, it's a big, big retirement spot now.
Hmm.
But anyway, I bought the Sora aircraft. Yeah, and like all young pilots, you know, I just, all I wanted to do was go fly.
Yeah, huh.
And you know, the guy that I bought it from, he gave me a couple of hours worth of instruction, and we did some touch and goes. And but I was totally unprepared for this little plane. The flying part was no big deal. It was the landing and takeoff, so I just didn't have the experience. So I spent $1,900 to buy this little airplane, and I was only making $5,000 a year at the time.
Wow.
And I was out practicing touch and goes, and one day, and I didn't have too many hours in the plane. I mean, I'd only had maybe 5 or 6 hours at this point. And I destroyed the, not destroyed, I crashed the airplane. When I landed, I got caught in a little crosswind that I wasn't able to compensate for. And I did I just forgot the term. You know, I pressed on the wrong pedal at the wrong time, and I did a real quick turnaround on the strip.
Like a 180 kind of thing?
Well, yes, exactly. It was a 180.
Okay.
And but in doing so, I ended up tipping over. I put the prop into the ground. Of course, that's no good for the engine.
Yep.
And the wing went into the ground, and I broke the left wheel strut. So I found out that it was going to cost me $1,300 to repair this thing. So I know that when I called my wife, you know, after this wreck, and we'd gotten the wreck off of the runway, and this is a little isolated strip out at Overton, and there isn't much traffic there, so that wasn't too much of an issue, but we got it off the runway. And I know I called my wife, and I was probably in tears, and told her that I'd wrecked this plane, and she probably made the best decision of my life by saying something to the effect of, we can't, either we're going to have kids, or we're going to buy another plane, but we can't afford both.
Right.
And, of course, I have two great sons and four beautiful grandchildren. So that was a super decision on her part. Had it been left to me, I probably would have gone forward. But at the same time, I'd accepted a transfer to Death Valley. And we had a going away party. So my best friend at the time, Don Chase, still is my best friend, I guess, Don Chase. He and I, and he was much more mechanically inclined than I was, and we went out and took the wings off of this little airplane. And we were to go to a going-away party for me. It was my going-away party with my wife and I, and we were to be at the Boulder Beach Visitor Center, and, you know, Rangers and, you know, a few others would be there. I'd only been there a year and a half, so I didn't know people that well, and they didn't know me all that well. But the superintendent was there. Roger Allen was there. Well, I missed my going away party. That was the part that I was sort of embarrassed to tell you. But the party was supposed to have been at a certain time, I thought, but it turns out it was an hour earlier.
Ooh.
So Don and I are driving in just as everybody is leaving.
This
party, which had been for my wife and I, of course she was there, and I'm totally embarrassed. I'm almost embarrassed to tell you, but I was more embarrassed at the time. So I literally went around to almost everybody, certainly the superintendent and the chief ranger and others, and personally apologized to them. It was an oversight on my part. It was certainly not very classy on my part. And, my wife was not very happy with me, that was for sure. But, as I say, she was there. So that was my other real definite encounter with Roger Allen, who which is how I got into that story to begin with, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
Well, you mentioned that he was good to his people.
Yeah.
But
he was certainly good to me in my small sphere of people.
Okay.
Okay. But, you know, how he was received by all the other people at Lake Mead, I can't speak to that, really.
Right. No worries. The question I had for you about Lake Mead, in the 50s, looking at the accident reports for the different western parks, Lake Mead National Recreation Area had a high incidence of fatalities.
Yeah.
A lot of them alcohol-related with boats.
Yep.
Can you speak to that a little bit? Was that something that you saw when you were there?
I saw a lot of that.
Okay.
I made a fair number of arrests for under the influence, either in a vehicle or in a boat.
Okay.
I was involved prior to my time getting there. One of the reasons they wrote this job description for somebody like myself, where they were having these big-time accidents where there'd be 3 and 4 people killed in a car wreck.
Right.
Along that North Shore Road or some of the other auxiliary roads around there because of the speed and the drinking.
Okay.
So, and again, part of my job as an area ranger, not as a North Shore patrolman, but as an area ranger, was I'd go out in the boat. And we had the luxury of picking and choosing, and no one really told us, well, go out on the boat today or do this or whatever. We had, there were 3 rangers stationed at Echo Bay at that time, and I had the most law enforcement experience, but I didn't have the boating experience, for one. But we'd go out on the lake, and... we would be right at the, before we go out on the lake, we would monitor who was going out, who was launching, and what their status was. I mean, you would watch them and talk to them and that sort of thing. So you knew who was launching and who might be giving you trouble later on.
Hmm.
And, big weekend, 110 degrees, lots of beer, a fast boat. It's a recipe for disaster in some cases, for sure. Big open basins where there's a lot of room to, open that throttle up and zoom around the lake.
Yep.
So I saw a fair amount of that. I'm trying to think if I don't really remember being involved where anyone died on the lake in a alcohol-related boat accident. I got involved in quite a few drownings. I seem to remember something like diving on probably 30 drownings.
Okay.
Or, maybe 1 or 2 boating accidents as well, but mostly just drownings. And, it wasn't that I recovered all of them, but I participated in that many dive searches,
mm-hmm.
Probably found, maybe 8 or 9 that I found, but, helped search for the rest of them.
Uh-huh.
And some of them are very, were pretty dangerous in some ways. Certainly unique, some of them are pretty mundane. You know, if a body recovery can be a mundane thing, they were pretty routine.
Uh-huh.
From my perspective, not a big deal. I'm sure from the family's perspective, that's different. But
yes.
But in this case, I did a fair amount of diving, and that was one of the beauties. That's one of the beauties of being a park ranger in general, is that, if you've got the interest and, perhaps the physical ability and mostly the interest, however,
uh-huh.
You can get involved in all kinds of things. And, I end up going back through a diving school, a 2-week diving school at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in La Jolla, California, as a result of being a ranger at Lake Mead.
Really? Now, you had mentioned the diving school that you kind of slipped into at Glen Canyon.
Correct.
And so tell me a little bit about this, the diving school at Scripps here.
Well, this is, you know, I just a couple of days ago got, you know, the Southern Man and I wrote a history of National Park Service diving, the administrative history, and I just got the books the other day to sign.
Nice.
To send them off. So I have a pretty good feeling for the diving program in the national parks, certainly historically. And the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, you know, the University of California system has quite a biological and research component to it that involves oceanography. And so they had to have, you know, a professional diving cadre to teach these graduate students, mostly graduate students, how to dive.
Okay.
And the Park Service, and there's a long story to that, which I won't get into, but the Park Service was able to make arrangements with a man by the name of Jim Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, who this book I just mentioned a moment ago, which is not open for general purchase, you know, is dedicated to he and another guy.
Oh, nice.
So he's sort of the godfather of National Park Service diving. So Jim would have a two-week school every year, and rangers from around mostly the West or the Southwest would go to it. There'd only be about 12 or so rangers going. And there might have been a maintenance man or two in there as well, but mostly it was, you know, protection rangers.
Okay.
Such as myself. For me, the first week was in La Jolla, diving off the coast and going through the Scripps, the school aspect of it in a school room. But then we had access to a pool and did a lot of early diving training in it.
Okay.
Now, in my case, I was sort of a retread, I guess. There are probably a few other people there who had never been taught diving. And so the first week was in La Jolla, and then the second week was back at Lake Mead, actually.
Oh, wow.
So they brought this whole class over to Lake Mead. We drove from La Jolla back and spent the next week diving in the waters of Lake Mead. And we ended up getting two certifications. One was from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, which had its own credentialing system. And then also Jim was also a NAWI. Let me think about this. Let's see. National underwater instructors, national something underwater instructors. So I ended up leaving with that certificate. And then, you know, when I was in Yosemite, I actually went back to an advanced class there, a dive master class as well.
Oh, okay.
But, terribly well respected. At the time, it might have been one of the only school system that had a diving, cadre. I think probably in Florida and others, maybe Woods Hole kinds of places, developed it afterwards. But Scripps is right at the very cutting edge of diving and oceanography. Of course, there's lots of graduate programs in oceanography-related things. But so we got part of that. And then, of course, from our need, it was really for body recoveries, principally.
Right.
A little bit of maintenance. You know, we moved buoys around and did, occasionally somebody would drop something valuable off of a dock, and we might go down and get something that some visitor dropped.
Okay.
But mostly it was body recovery. That's what we did a lot of, anyway.
And the there's a couple of interesting dives there in Lake Mead. There's some sort of a bomber doing some low water.
B-29.
Okay. And that it's fairly deep, isn't it? I mean, yeah. In the deeper sections, it's a 600-700 feet deep. Is that right?
No, it's not nearly that deep. It's okay. About 200 feet.
Oh, all right. No, not where the bomber is, but further down toward the dam.
Oh, down by the dam. I don't know if it's 600. It's like, yeah, maybe close to 500, though.
Okay, which is deep enough.
Oh, no, it's certainly deep. It's certainly more than, you know, technically we could only go to 130 feet.
Okay.
And this B-29, which I've never seen, I never dove on it. In fact, I'm not even sure I knew it existed at the time. And most people didn't, I don't believe.
Right.
But with the lake level going up and down, it has become a dive site.
Right.
And the lake is a lot lower than when I was there. But you could dive on the B-29 now. And it's an advanced dive. I think at least one person's already died as a result.
Hmm.
But, most places, many places, visibility is very limited.
Right.
There are a few places in the lake where the visibility might be 20 feet or so if you're lucky. And, you know, it's not someplace, if you compare that to Hawaii or lots of other places that I've dove around the world, certainly not very attractive. But if you live in Las Vegas, and that's the closest big piece of water, that's where you go. So, I made one of the dives that I made that was pretty spooky was this other ranger myself, Don Weir, who probably had more experience than I did. But a fisherman drowned at the upper end of Overton, the Overton Arm, and lots of tamarisk growing up through the water.
Right.
So the fisherman went over, and he had... I don't know that he had waders on, but for some reason he went down pretty fast.
Okay.
And they had a fairly good idea of where he was. They saw where he went down. So Don and I went up, and the visibility was zero.
Whoa.
And so we held hands and went down, and you've got the tamarisk that you've got to contend with, and there's lots of them. I mean, it's just not, there are all these little, not seedlings, but little saplings, you know, just skinny little 20 foot high.
If the reservoir level has come up recently, then what was a tamarisk on the shore or on the kind of a area where water would inundate suddenly is underwater, and you have to work your way through this thicket of tamarisk with your regulator and all the rest of your gear. Wow.
Correct. And you did that with the boat as well. I mean, you go up and we tie off to a tamarisk, and to some degree, we were doing it just for the sake of the family.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't think we had any great expectations that we were actually going to find this guy in zero visibility, and we didn't.
Okay.
And we spent a couple of tanks, holding hands and just sort of thumping around, trying to feel to see if we could find this guy. And in some ways, I'm glad we didn't. It's hard enough to deal with somebody like that on the surface, but when you got to do it on zero visibility and underneath 20 feet of water. But ultimately, this guy surfaced after about 8 or 10 days.
Okay.
And we went out and got him, brought him back in. So, diving, it was, exciting and interesting, and you had to be prepared for it. But again, if you're 26 years old, 26 or so, and, you're fairly confident in your skill level, because I was an all-state swimmer in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'm pretty comfortable in the water. But, so it was interesting, and it was exciting most of the time.
Yeah.
But it was just part of the job. You didn't, you didn't focus on that. You did other stuff as well. And my thing there really was to get to know the resource. I've always contended that if rangers don't get out in range, how do you know what to protect?
Right.
And there are some, fairly minimal but still existing archaeology sites around Echo Bay and that part of the lake. I made a point of trying to find those, and I knew where, some of the endangered pupfish were located. So that was my thing. I mean, this conservation preservation ethic sort of kicked in at this point as well. And if it was a, quiet afternoon, if there wasn't much going on, then I would take off in probably a four-wheel drive pickup and just go explore some of the little dirt roads that exist.
Oh, fun.
Just so that I could say that I knew. And, part of it was to see what's going on out there, too.
Yeah.
I discovered an airfield that somebody had plowed.
Oh, wow.
Graded. And I suspect that it had something to do with drugs, but
sure.
I never did find anybody on it. But, that was part of my job, was to be out there ranging.
Right.
So,
yeah.
There are lots of fun things at Lake Mead. Let me give you one more fun.
Please.
But so I think very interesting example. It was a major weekend, something like the 4th of July or Labor Day. I don't recall which it was, but the outlaw motorcycle group, the Sundowners, which were somewhat equivalent to the Hells Angels, but were in the Las Vegas area, they were not welcome in Forest Service areas and other areas where they could camp. But they were welcome at Lake Mead. And it wasn't like we had our big open arms for them, but we were still allowing them to camp. And so they were having this encampment where they were having all of their members come out. They were going to camp out for a couple of days. And you can, it's a hot weekend, and you can see what's coming, right?
Yep.
With lots of, mostly alcohol. There might have been drugs that I don't know about, but mostly alcohol. So the first night, we know that they're coming, and Don and I are in a patrol car and just sort of wandering around at night. I'm sure we weren't even getting paid. It was just, this is what we had to do. And we look at the top of the launch ramp, and there's a big gathering of probably 30 to 40 of these, not rogue, what am I trying to say, bikers anyway. Standing or milling around, and they had some of the women were with them, but they didn't know where to go. That was part of the thing. And so Don and I drive up there, and when I was in the Tucson PD, I dealt with the Hells Angels a fair amount.
Uh-huh.
And was sort of used to working with motorcycle clubs, even though there was some danger involved. But being the cocky guy that I was, I get out of the car, and Don doesn't want to get out of the car. And I walk right in the middle of this group and say, okay, who's the boss here? And somebody's identified, and I sort of lay out for them real quickly what they can do and what they can't do. And I said, you guys are looking for your camp spot as a group site, not in the main campground, it was sort of off to the side. And so we took them over there. And they, were fine. And so the next day, we're back out patrolling around. In this case, I'm by myself. And I get a call of a Winnebago or a motorhome anyway. The guy has backed up, and he's about to go over this embankment of about 30 or 40 feet and drop into about 40 feet of water with this Winnebago kind of a thing. And, it's hot and it's crowded and there's lots of things going on around that part of the lake. There weren't any wreckers available at the time that could help this Winnebago guy out. So I look up at the top of this ramp, and here are these same 30 and 40 bikers standing around. I said, okay, Mr. Smith, whatever your name is, don't panic. But I'm going to come back here in a few minutes and probably be able to help you. So I go up, and I'd already fixed one guy's ankle. He'd twisted his ankle, and I taped it up for him. And so they knew me, and they were a little bit used to me, I guess. And so I said, do you guys want to prove that you're not as bad as a lot of people think you are? And, you know, I think the sentiment was, okay, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think they were jumping up and down. But okay. So I said, okay, follow me. So we all walked down to where this Winnebago was. And I said, okay, we're going to push this Winnebago back up the hill. And it wasn't like it was over, too far down, but it was. But he couldn't. He was trapped.
Right.
And there's a real potential for him to have this thing go into the water and sink.
Hmm.
So I got all these guys behind it, and we pushed this Winnebago back up onto the flat ground. No cost to this guy, so he ends up, you know, probably much to my chagrin, going down and buying a couple of cases of beer. But as a result, though, if my interaction with these guys over the next day or two, they literally wanted to induct me into as an honorary member of this biking club.
Oh, that's nice.
Which I regret not ever actually doing.
Oh.
And I don't know that they would have given me any kind of colors or anything, but it would have been a nice memento.
Yeah.
Of having been inducted into this outlaw biking club. So anyway, that's the story I wanted to tell you about the bikers.
The Winnebago Pushers Award. Yeah, good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, nice. I mean, you know, and you had to, you know, think on your feet.
Yeah.
Outside the box.
Yep.
And maybe I'm giving myself too much credit, but I always like to think I can think outside the box on these kinds of things.
So. And, you know, people want to be friendly, and there's not much going on, and, yeah, they can help.
Well, actually, there was a heck of a lot going on. It was just that it was an efficient, expedient way to take care of a problem.
Right.
That were, if it worked, everyone comes out a winner.
Right.
So.
Yeah. There was a ranger out there for a while named Chuck Luttrell.
I don't remember that name.
Okay, he might have been a little after you. That's just
everybody's after me. I mean, I'm that old. So.
Yeah. I just wanted to check there, and I also wanted to, and this may not be the appropriate time to talk about this, but I want to ask you to ponder it. You're mentioning it's during the days when anyone in maintenance or interpretive ranger or law enforcement, yep. if you had the interest, you could be part of the diving team or part of the search and rescue team or part of the ropes team. Or that was going to change, and people became much more specialized, and you couldn't, if you were in maintenance, you couldn't, you know, be part of the search and rescue team because you needed to be a search and rescue ranger for that.
Well, sort of. I would make that as black and white as you make it sound.
Okay.
Part of it has to do with being willing, you know, like as an example, this is, I'm jumping out of Lake Mead going to the Grand Canyon, but when I was the assistant chief ranger and was responsible for the SAR program and EMS and fire and whatever, you know, one of the interpreters was a paramedic, Lois Frederick, and very talented, very good guy.
Uh-huh.
And so I just reached out to him and said, you know, we need you. Would you like to participate? And he was very eager, and he got, you know, permission from his boss and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
So I dovetailed him in.
And what year was that?
Well, that would have been, well, I was at Grand Canyon from 81 to 87.
Yeah, and I think, and this is 2020, so I guess I'm speaking from today versus the late 60s in this what is a 50-year time span. I would like to hope that, you know, if somebody was an EMT and they were an interpretive ranger, that they would be able to use those skills in other areas.
Well, it's a two-way street. That interpretive ranger has to let it be known that they're interested. But if you're, say, responsible, like I was at the Grand Canyon, if you're responsible for a program, then you have to be willing to reach out as well.
Yeah.
It's a two-way street.
I see.
So I wouldn't be as black and white about that, not segregation, but that, you know, you can't participate because you're in maintenance. The fact is that Glen Canyon, for the last, 30 or more years, the all the body recovery stuff was being run by a maintenance guy.
Okay.
And
oh, good. All right.
And then Lake Mead, long after I was there, of course, but they got into a lot of research, and the researchers were the divers. They weren't in. They actually turned all the body recovery stuff over to Clark County.
Okay.
And the park, sort of to my disappointment, this is, again, after I retired pretty much, but, you know, I always thought rangers ought to get involved in that stuff as well. So, but I have one thing to tell you about Lake Mead that is really pretty important.
Please.
And it is, while I was there, and again, I was there 69 and 70. I was there for like 18 months, roughly. But while I was there, everyone has sort of heard of the Yosemite riot, July 4th, 1970. But about a month before that, maybe 6 weeks before that, a seasonal ranger killed a young kid at Lake Mead. And I don't have it at my fingertips. I never even thought that it might be of relevance. But it turns out, I think in my mind right now, that it's very important when it comes to law enforcement and the national parks.
Okay.
Because the seasonal ranger, his name was Lamoureux, had very little training in law enforcement. And again, this is during the days when there, you know, rangers did not have any law enforcement training. I was one of the exceptions to this. And he was a patrolman in Boulder Beach. For whatever reason, I wasn't in the park, I don't even think. But I certainly wasn't involved with it. But he's on patrol at the Boulder Beach swimming area, and a 16-year-old boy is being a 16-year-old boy, just sort of raising Cain a little bit. So he ends up driving around the Boulder Beach campground, and I don't remember exactly what he was doing, but something as innocuous as driving the wrong way around the camping loop. And the seasonal ranger, who was a teacher most of the year, and he was a teacher with kids that were troubled.
Okay.
In the school district. I think he was with Henderson, actually, Henderson School District. And he dealt with these kids day in and day out for years. So he was on patrol, and he had a sidearm on. And he stops this young 16-year-old boy. Well, as it turns out, this boy is the son of a Lake Mead employee. His mother is maybe like in the personnel office or something there at Lake Mead. So this Lamoureux stops this young boy. The young boy walks away from him. I don't know that they got into any kind of a verbal thing, but he ignores the ranger's demands, and so the ranger goes up, and he pulls his weapon, and he accidentally discharges it, and the boy ends up dying a day later.
Oh, my gosh.
And no training, totally almost like what's currently going on in Minneapolis. No need for any of this. It was way too high-handed. Part of it has to do with just lack of training, perhaps lack of perspective.
Right.
And regardless, this young boy dies, and of course, the kids in the school district and the Boulder City kids, and young people anyway, get very much upset, and they actually have a pretty significant protest in Boulder City, breaking windows there at the park office, which is in Boulder City. And they had to bring in some rangers to talk to these kids. And it was only about 5 or 6 weeks, roughly, before the 4th of July riot. Well, of course, this gets the attention of management back in Washington, D.C., park management. And then you have this riot, quote-unquote, in Yosemite. And of course, there was a lot of things working up to that as well.
Right.
It wasn't like it was totally isolated. But right. It was the straw that broke the camel's back in some ways.
Hmm.
And, you know, you couple that with what was taking place around the country with Vietnam protests and the race riots and what have you, of that era, which a lot of us will remember very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Park Service recognizes or starts to recognize that it's totally inept when it comes to dealing with this younger counterculture, anti-establishment sentiment that's taking place around the country. And they recognized that, you know, they needed to get on board with some of this. So, you know, there was a sea change when it came to how the Park Service dealt with law enforcement and this younger generation and some of the social ills that were taking place, again, around the country. And, you know, national parks were not immune to any of this. In some places, you know, maybe even focused on some of these ills. So, you know, I just want to mention this young boy who sort of has become lost. I mean, this incident has sort of become lost in the history, because everybody reflects back on the Yosemite riot as being a big deal, which it was, but it also, there are things that led up to it as well. So.
Yeah.
That makes sense to you?
It does, and I would like to explore this more, but I'm looking at the time here, and we've been happily yik-yakking for about an hour and a quarter, not bad. I wonder if this would be a good time to wrap up part four, and then part five, I would like to explore the Yosemite riot a little more, that concept of changing culture, changing time, and the Park Service with a non-impairment mandate, which is leave it as it is, but how do they change with the times?
Not very well.
Well, yeah, and I wonder if that's something we can talk to for a little while.
Yeah, but we have to sort of go through Death Valley to get there, though, too.
Okay, so maybe that is the appropriate avenue. Is we could wrap this up here, and we could head out to Death Valley on our return.
Yeah, I've already broken my airplane. I'm being transferred to Death Valley. I've missed my going away party.
Right.
So it's time to move on to Death Valley.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, hang on a second. This will conclude the part four oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee Jr. Today is June 5th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Butch, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.